Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 165. My name is Terry Frost, and this time we're doing a couple of Academy Award winning movies with a couple of Academy Award winning performances in them. First off, we go to 1968 for the adaptation of Kyson McCullough's first novel, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, starring Alan Arkin and Sandra Locke. Then we go to 1971 for Clute, starring Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland. Both Alan Arkin and Jane Fonda won Oscars for these two movies, and they're really interesting films, and I hadn't seen them for a long time, so I really enjoyed revisiting them and just reminding myself how good they are. So anyway, sit back, relax, I'm going to get the contact details out of the way, and then talk a little bit about movies. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. So, how's everybody going? We are cold here. We got an Antarctic vortex, which means that the weather got cold. Basically, the east coast of Australia, as far as Queensland, got really, really cold. The cats aren't going outside. The weather is shitty. And, fuck you, climate change. Haven't been doing all that much. The radio is on hiatus for a little while because, for some reason, they preferred to listen to AFL football for a couple of weeks than to listen to me waffling on about movies. But that's fine. Liz and I are going to get back into it. We're going to do a little mini festival on the ABC Local Radio Northern Territory gig, where we look at movies that were filmed in the Northern Territory. So we're going to start out with an Australian film called We of the Never Never, and then we're going to work our way up from there. So we're going to have about 4 weeks of movies that are kind of geographically located in the listenership area. So I'm looking forward to that. It's a little bit different for us, so we're going to have a bit of fun. I just dropped something. The other thing is that I've done a big redesign on the man cave. I had a whole stacks of books just sitting in a built-in closet in the man cave. But I thought I should get a bookshelf in there and try to rationalise this and get rid of the stuff I'm not going to read again and do all of that. So basically I've got about half a cubic metre of books that I'm getting rid of. And they're all stacked up outside the man cave door, because I didn't want to block up the man cave. And I've now got all of my crime novels and my science fiction novels and all of that kind of stuff in really nice looking bookshelves. So that's been done this weekend, and I've physically exhausted myself lifting and carrying a couple of tons of books. Now, all of the movie reference books are already taken care of. I did have my priorities and I got all the movie reference books sorted out. But now I've got the other stuff sorted out. And to be honest with you, it's looking kind of nice. I'm happy with that. And getting rid of the other books is going to be a problem because I've got to find somebody who wants half a cubic meter of miscellaneous crime and science fiction novels. If anybody wants to come around with a truck, happy to donate them for a six-pack. But, that's going to be the next little adventure, is finding something to do with these fucking books that I've got. Anything I've got on ebooks, I've kind of ditched because ebooks are just so much more convenient and I need the space as well. I keep collecting other things and starting to collect other things, so I need the room in the man cave. So that was all done this weekend because I couldn't really go out because it was too cold, so I generated a lot of heat just by lifting and carrying books. But anyway, it's time to talk about what I've been watching. Okay, so I've cranked up the Letterboxd, and what I've been watching, I'll go backwards from today just to make it a little bit different. I saw the De Niro and Stallone film Grudge Match, where they play two old boxers who fought back in the day and they get a grudge match together when they find out that various betrayals took place and all that kind of thing. It's a little bit like Jake LaMotta versus Rocky Balboa. And, it's not too bad. It's got Kim Basinger in it, who's still looking very, very nice. It has Alan Arkin in it, who is in The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. So I watched that mostly because Alan Arkin was in it, and I wanted to see what he was doing now. And he plays like an old fart with a hearing aid who talks dirty and all sorts of things like that. You got De Niro and Stallone looking really fit for men of their age and just kind of having at it in a very brutal boxing match at the end of the film. But yeah, it's kind of, you know, the expected ending happens and all that kind of thing. There's nothing too predictable in there. And neither of them particularly brings their A-game acting. And Stallone is at times a better actor than he's often given credit for. But, yeah, so I watched that, and yeah, it wasn't a total waste of time. It was a cold day. I'd finished moving all of the books around and decided to just sit down in front of pretty much that and watched it. I did see a really nice documentary about Harry Dean Stanton called Harry Dean Stanton Partly Fiction, which part of it is him singing old songs, old country songs. Part of it is people talking about his life and his career and little bits of clips in it. It's woven through very nicely. They follow Harry Dean Stanton around various bars in LA and other places. And it's got a very kind of low-key feel to it. It's a German documentary. It was made by a German documentary company. But it does look at Harry Dean Stanton's career. And it does point out that Paris, Texas was his first starring role. He'd been a jobbing actor for like 30-odd years before he ever did Wim Wenders' Paris, Texas. And it just shows the art of the man. And he's one of those guys who acts the way Fred Astaire dances. He makes it look really easy and underplays what he does, but it's very, very artful and very superb acting from Harry Dean Stanton. Even in his little cameo in the first Avengers movie was a joy to watch. So I watched that. I did see a very bad Charles Band movie, one of the early Charles Band movies that I'd seen a long, long time ago. I think I may have seen it in the cinemas at the Town Cinema in Sydney when it first came out, and that's Laser Blast, which has got some nice little CGI aliens and a teenage kid who gets an alien blaster and starts blasting everybody around the place. It's got Eddie Deason's first role, and Eddie Deason's a Facebook friend of mine. You might remember him from any number of things, including 1941 and a few other bits and pieces. Yeah, so Laser Blast, I'd kind of watched that. It's one of those things. It was a chewing gum movie. You just chew it through it while you're doing other things. So I watched that. Very bad music in it. Not a good film at all, really. And I just saw a documentary called The Unbelievers about Lawrence Krauss and Richard Dawkins. Now, Richard Dawkins, the first syllable of his last name pretty much says that he's a dork. There are sexist things that he says and other things that he says that are kind of not quite in alignment with my philosophy. But as an atheist, I didn't mind it. And I like Lawrence Krauss a lot more. Lawrence Krauss was on Q&A. Last week here in Australia and talked about his non-belief and science and rationality and all those kind of issues. So it was an okay doco. It wasn't anything special. Just followed them around while they were making various talks and stuff like that. I saw it on Netflix, but it was, you know, kind of okay, but nothing special. It was kind of a bit of an ego stroke documentary to the two gentlemen involved. And, yeah, I don't think it brings anything new to the table particularly. I did rewatch a movie from a while back, L.A. Confidential, because I've been reading James Ellroy's novels, particularly the L.A. trio of novels that he did, starting with The Big Nowhere and going through L.A. Confidential and that. And, yeah, I like it. It's got Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe, and I just bumped the microphone. It's got Kevin Spacey and Kim Basinger in an Oscar-winning role. It really evokes early 1950s Hollywood beautifully. The set design and the locations and everything are really good, and the acting, of course, is superb. And it's got that sleazy James Ellroy kind of feel about it, so it does hit the tone very right. Curtis Hanson does a great job of that. So I did enjoy watching that. It was good to revisit it. I've forgotten enough about it that it kept it interesting for me. And, yeah, it was on, again, it was on Netflix, so I just kind of decided to have a go at that. It was one of those serendipitous discoveries that I could do now that I've got Netflix. The only other thing I saw was a movie made by the guys who did the Trailer Park Boys up in Canada called Swearnet, which was kind of a pseudo-documentary about them as themselves, not as the characters, starting up a website and all sorts of things. It's got the usual gross-out humour. It's got the usual silliness in it. And it was okay. You know, I've got to keep in touch with my Canadian brothers and sisters, so I watched that as well. But that's about it for what I've watched. I'm not going to talk any more about that. I'm going to take a break now, and I've decided to start something in Paleo Cinema Podcast where I play a tune that's kind of got the mood for Paleo Cinema. It's very much in the Paleo Cinema mode. And this time it is Mr. Bobby Darin singing Once in a Lifetime.
Once in a lifetime, a man knows a moment, one wonderful moment, when fate takes his hand. And this is my moment, my once in a lifetime, when I can explore a new and exciting land. For once in my lifetime, you know I feel like a child. I saw like an eagle, as though I had wings. For this is my moment, my destiny calls me. And though it may be just once in my lifetime, I'm gonna do great things. Just once in a lifetime, a man knows a moment, one wonderful moment, when fate grabs his hand. And this is my moment, my once in a lifetime, when I can explore a new and exciting land. Oh, once in my lifetime, you know I feel like a giant. I'm gonna soar like an eagle, as though I had wings. My destiny calls me, and though it may be just once in my lifetime, I'm gonna do a great thing.
That's what I'm talking about. Mr. Bobby Darin. I really should do a Bobby Darin movie for the podcast at some stage. Maybe Too Late Blues, the one he did with Stella Stevens for John Cassavetes back in the early 1960s. Maybe I should do that. I'll put it on the list. But anyway, we're going to talk now about a much more serious film, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, based on the 1940 novel, the first novel, written by Carson McCullers, who was an American female novelist who did only live to be 50. She had a lot of medical problems and alcohol problems and drug problems and a series of strokes, and unfortunately she stepped on the rainbow at the age of 50. I saw this movie first a long time ago. It was one of those serendipitous discoveries. These days we do serendipity via things like Netflix, but this was like a late night television one way back, maybe 30 years ago, could be more, where I was kind of channel surfing back when there were only a few television networks here in Australia. And Heart is a Lonely Hunter was coming up, so I thought I'd watch it. And I got stuck watching it. And, yep, it's emotional. It's a weepy movie in some ways, but I like it a lot. And it's very different from a lot of other American films of the time. Alan Arkin won an Academy Award for this film, which is justified too. I mean, you could always do the Tropic Thunder argument that, you know, to win the Oscar, you never go full retard. Instead, in this one, Alan Arkin's playing a man called John Singer, who is a deaf mute living in a southern town. Originally, the IMDb praise, which is pretty short. When a deaf mute singer moves to a small town to be near his only friend who's confined in a hospital, he grows attached to his landlady's sensitive 16-year-old daughter. Now, that's not entirely accurate. I'll give you the storyline from IMDb, which is slightly better. Sentimental story centers around a deaf-mute singer and Mick, a teenage girl who lives in the house where he rents a room. Mick and singer become friends, though they are separated by singer's lack of communication ability and Mick's struggle with teenage problems. The lives of the people singer touches are varied, linked only by their friendship to singer. His friends include a deaf-mute, a drunk, and a doctor. Singer does his best to help those around him to solve their problems, but who is there to help him solve his? Now, the movie starts out, well, it was directed by Robert Ellis Miller, who didn't do a lot of movies, but this one he did very well, and he was a man of talent. He died in about 2003, I think it is. No, he's actually still alive. I apologise. I was thinking of somebody else. And he did a number of things. He directed a number of movies, a lot of TV stuff. He did Reuben Reuben, The Butterfly Chain, The Girl from Petrovka with Goldie Hawn, and a bunch of other stuff, none of which is particularly distinguished, apart from The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And, yeah, this one really is one of those movies that you, if you saw it at a certain age, you'll really like it a lot. Along with Alan Arkin, we've got Sandra Locke playing Mick, the young girl. She was actually 23 at the time, but she's playing a teenager in the movie. Stacey Keach playing Blount, the drunk, and he's very good in it as well. Biff McGuire playing Mick's father, Mr. Kelly. Percy Rodriguez playing Dr. Copeland, and Cicely Tyson playing Portia Copeland, his daughter. Now, you could construe this movie as being either Southern Gothic or a little bit of a soap opera kind of thing, but I think it transcends it. I think it's much more than that. It's a bit dismissive for somebody to do that. But anyway, I'll play the trailer for the film, which has a nice voiceover and also has Sandra Locke reciting some of the text from Carson McCullough's original book.
When a 22-year-old Georgia girl wrote her first book, she became the youngest American writer ever to join the company of immortals. Her name, Carson McCullers. She called her book, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. She told about herself at 16, about what she liked and saw and wanted.
This was the first party I ever gave. I'd never even been to more than four or five.
It was nice you let me come.
Well, I was flattered you wanted to. I mean, we're so much younger than you. 2 years behind in school.
Oh, well, I didn't have anything better to do.
She told about the man who came to live in her family's house.
The other people had been ordinary, but Mr. Singer was not.
Hi, Mr. Singer. Want to come look at my party?
Really? Singer was always talking to Antonopoulos. His hand shaped the words in a swift series of designs.
She told about the violent stranger.
He was like a man who had served a term in prison, or had been to Harvard College, or lived for a long time with foreigners in South America.
Well, you got a heart, you know that?
Okay, mister, that's enough.
Hey, it's a free country.
Well, the country may be free, but the beer ain't. Now, you just come along nice and quiet before I have to get rough.
Well, okay, boy.
She told about the proud doctor.
All his life, he knew there was a reason for his working. He always knew that he was meant to teach his people.
What do you want? That is a white man. I only treat my own.
But most of all, she told about herself.
I felt very old, and it was like something was heavy inside me. I'd become a grown person now, whether I wanted to be or not.
I never did more than kiss a girl before this.
Me neither.
Carson McCullers looked straight into the people around her and saw to the heart of their loneliness, their pity, and their terror. She made of them a masterpiece called The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. Now that masterpiece is a motion picture.
That's got to be one of the most earnest trailers I've ever played on Paleo Cinema Podcast. The narration, by the way, was by Andrew Duggan, a jobbing character actor of the day. I think that it was really, it was by Warner Brothers Seven Arts, and Warner Brothers has always had a history of having a kind of blue-collar approach to movie making. It no longer has that, but from the 1920s onwards, that was the approach. That was very much a blue-collar, social justice kind of movie studio, and this movie's consistent with that as well. It talks about the civil rights. Two of the main characters are black, the Dr. Copeland, played by Percy Rodriguez, and his daughter Portia, and her husband as well, who gets involved with it. And then you've got Stacy Keach playing the drunkard who's kind of passing through, and who Singer helps in several ways, one of which Blount, the character played by Stacy Keach, gets drunk and then angry and starts beating his fists against the wall. And it's Singer who gets Dr. Copeland to treat him to first aid on site because he's passed out, his hands are bleeding, he's hurt himself a fair bit. And because Dr. Copeland only treats people of colour, it takes some persistence on Singer's behalf to get him to treat Blount. Now, Blount and Singer, Blount gets taken back to Singer's room and sleeps there, and they form a form of friendship. Now, one of the things about this movie that makes it more engaging is the fact that Singer's ability to communicate is very limited. And one of the things that's said about him, which is an odd thing to say to somebody who's a deaf mute, is that he's a good listener. And he's got an essential kindness, but he's also got a personal tragedy. And that personal tragedy involves the his best friend, a guy called Spiros Antonopoulos, played very broadly by Chuck McCann. Now, Spiros is another deaf-mute who lived previously in another town with Singer. And they were very, very close. There's strong indications that Spiros has developmental difficulties, whether he's got some level of retardation or whether they relate to maybe him not getting the education he needed early on. It's hard to tell in this movie. It doesn't go into too many details. But he's basically a big kind of Lenny character from of Mice and Men to a certain extent. And as I said, Chuck McCann, who was known for doing voiceovers and comedy, wasn't known as a serious actor, mugs and overplays the role a little bit, which kind of diminishes the effectiveness of it. But there are some scenes where he does show some kind of nuanced acting. Now, there's a lot of discussion when people talk about the book and the movie of The Heart is the Lonely Hunter as to whether Singer and Antonopoulos are lovers, whether there's a gay relationship or not. And I kind of did a bit of research on that and thought it around a little bit. It doesn't really matter whether they are or not, whether they've got a sexual relationship. They've got a very, very, very strong bond together. They're both deaf-mute men living in a town. Singer works as an engraver in jewellery shops. And up until he's hospitalised, Antonopoulos worked in his cousin's grocery store, just doing kind of odd jobs around the grocery store. Now, we see Antonopoulos right at the start of the movie, where he's kind of gone out at night and Singer hasn't noticed that he's left their apartment, and breaks into a bakery store window to eat the pastries in the bakery store window. Of course, he doesn't hear the alarm go off and the cops get him, and it's found out that he does this sort of thing on a regular basis. And it's eventually decided, because, of course, Singer doesn't have power of attorney over Antonopoulos, though he is working towards getting that at the time that Antonopoulos is hospitalised. And part of the reason why he's moved to this new town, where he meets Mick and Blount and the Copelands and all of that, is to be closer to the state hospital where Antonopoulos has been incarcerated. And So the Antonopoulos singer relationship can be read either as a gay relationship or as one of two people who don't have anyone else to talk to and have built a very strong bond over the years because of that. Nobody else signs. A singer can read lips, though he does need to get people to repeat sometimes. But the only way for him to communicate with other people is for him to write notes on little scraps of paper. And that, of course, limits the bandwidth between him and other people who are not Antonopoulos or who are not deaf mutes. Now, there is a scene where Singer does help Dr. Copeland with a deaf mute client of his, and he needs to find out about symptoms and things like that, and talks in sign language to the young man of colour to get the information that Dr. Copeland needs to help him with his medical conditions and stuff like that. But apart from that, Singer is mostly there for other people. He finds out that Mick likes classical music, so he buys a record player and plays his records in his room so that she can hear them, even though, of course, he can't. And there's a scene where she tries to describe music to him, describe the particular music that he's playing on there. And he tries to understand and tries to make her feel better about the fact that he can't hear the music. And it's handled very well. Sandra Locke is quite good in the movie. She, of course, she's a little too old to play the character, but she does engage as Mick, the kind of tomboy teenage girl who's intelligent and sensitive and has a hard family circumstance. Her father has a hip injury, which means that he can't really do any work, and that changes their family circumstances in a way that impedes Mick's ability to get an education. She's got two younger brothers, one is his baby and her younger brother, who's pretty much her sounding board for a lot of things, and there's a good relationship there as well, which is well done in the movie. I've really got to read the novel. I'm going to have to try to track down a copy of the novel. But, just to get this movie together. It is very earnest. It is very kind of a serious film, but there are little bits of humour in there. There's a bit where Mick has her party with her friends over who are more better off than she is, and the party goes to hell because of her little brother and his syndicate of friends acting up a little bit. And there are some humorous scenes between Antonopoulos and Singer. So the movie isn't just one tone. Now, the movie does end tragically and in a way that's got a horrible logic. I'm not doing any spoilers on it, but it makes a lot of sense the way things pan out in this movie. And the plot has a logic to it that maybe we didn't quite realise until that point in the movie, which, it's well done for that. The first time I saw it, I was very shocked by the ending. But watching it again this time, and this is the second time I've seen the film, it makes sense. It explains a lot. It shows that, well, I can't really say more of what it shows without giving it away, but it's a good, solid film, and Alan Arkin is fantastic in it. Alan Arkin started his film career in a band called The Terriers, in a movie I mentioned in the previous podcast, Calypso Heatwave. He actually wrote the Banana Boat song, you know, that one Harry Belafonte sang. Alan Arkin wrote the lyrics for that. So that's something that is a nice little trivia piece as well. But I like this movie. It's not a movie I'm going to watch a lot because, to be honest with you, I did choke up at the end of it. And movies that I choke up at the end of, I tend to space out a lot in between viewings because I don't want them to lose that capacity to make me feel emotionally about the film. But this one does, and they're only, I could name three or four at the most movies that really do get me emotionally. And this is definitely one of them. It really is a fine piece of filmmaking. James Wong Howe is a cinematographer, and the cinematography is superb. It was filmed in Selma, Alabama, at a time when there were a lot of protests and things going on in Selma. But it addresses racial questions in an honest way, but not as the main focus of the text. But nonetheless, it is there. And Cicely Tyson and Percy Rodriguez are very good playing the two characters of colour in the film. Stacey Keach is very good in it as well. Stacey Keach did have a cocaine problem for a long time, and it did impede his career. But in this, he is very good. In fact, he did Shakespeare early in his career as well. He was a Shakespearean actor at one stage. But in this, he's very good, and it's a good, honest portrayal of a man who doesn't fit in and has his own demons, but is not, at the heart of things, a bad person, which is a hard one to act out. I mean, be playing a drunk, it's easy to go over the top when you're playing a drunk. It's easy to kind of over-egg the pudding. But in this, Stacey Keach does keep a good tone to it, and it plays it really well. The acting overall, with the possible exception of Chuck McCann as Antonopoulos, is top rate. And this is definitely, if you haven't seen this movie, you really should. And if you have seen it, but not for a long time, it is worth revisiting. It's not going to be a waste of time at all to rewatch The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about a slightly different movie from only 3 years later, but very much set in a different world, and that is the 1971 crime thriller Clute, starring Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland.
Ree Daniels.
One man is missing. Two girls lie dead, and somebody is on the other end of the phone. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid.
Who is it?
Ree Daniels. Can I come in?
Come in.
Ree Daniels, girl on the brink. Somewhere among her clientele is a freak who murders call girls.
Sit down.
And a wholly incredible cop who insists her life is worth saving.
I don't think he's going to come back again.
I just don't want to be alone right now.
Don't be afraid.
Do you remember about the man who beat you up?
Nothing. Except that he wasn't kidding, that's all.
But you cannot identify this man as Tom Gruneman.
I can't identify him as anybody.
Give me your hand. There's someone on the roof.
Did you like my friend Frankie?
Not very much. Hey. Your tapes.
Golly gee, just what I've always wanted. Dirty phone calls. Is Mr. Goldfarb there? I've got to talk to somebody. I'm just a little way across town. Can I come over?
Detective Trask, please. Hiya, John Clute. He didn't take the plane. He canceled out. Well, I think this man killed Jane McKenna and killed Arlen Page. I think he drowned them. I think you should prepare yourself for the fact that possibly Tom is dead. But the only way I'm going to find out is to find him.
All right, fine. I'll notify the board as soon as I get to Chicago.
Hello?
Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid.
Clute is a 1971 American crime thriller directed and produced by Alan J. Pakula and written by Andy and Dave Lewis. It stars Jane Fonda, Donald Sutherland, Charles Chioffi, or Chioffi, one of the two, and Roy Scheider. It's the story of a prostitute who assists a detective in solving a missing persons case. Now, the movie is apparently in a very loose trilogy with two other films, one of which I've done recently. on Paleo Cinema Podcast, that being The Parallax View, the movie with Warren Beatty in it. The third one in the trilogy is All the President's Men, so I assume now that I'm going to have to do All the President's Men at some stage, just so that we keep things nice and neat in case anybody has obsessive compulsive disorder out there, and I wouldn't want to trigger them at all. But Jane Fonda won the Academy Award for Best Actress in her role in the film. It's not the first time an actress has won an Academy Award for playing a prostitute. Just off the top of my head, Elizabeth Taylor did as well for Butterfield 8. But this one's a bit different. The cinematography is by Gordon Willis. And Gordon Willis was known as the Prince of Darkness because he tended to do very dark cinematography. And this movie is definitely no exception to that. Things are lit with a pseudo-natural lighting, available lighting kind of looks to it. And we also have to do a shout-out to the music by Michael Small, who hadn't done much in the way of soundtrack music before, but Bakula took a chance on him and he did very well with it. The music is very supportive of the screenplay and of the acting and things like that. Now, this movie is kind of interesting in a number of ways. The story is basically a Pennsylvania business executive, Tom Gruneman, played by Robert Milley, has vanished, and the company he works for in Tuscarora, Pennsylvania, gets one of their people, one of the security people, John Klutz, to go to New York City to start the investigation. Now, Tom Gruneman has ostensibly sent an obscene letter or written an obscene letter to be sent to a prostitute in New York by the name of Bree Daniels, played by Jane Fonda. So Klute, who isn't very knowledgeable in this sort of thing and admits at the start of the film that he hasn't done a missing persons investigation before and he's not very knowledgeable, goes to New York City, tries asking Bree straight up to answer a few questions and then bugs her apartment, getting himself a smaller apartment in the basement of the building and starts the investigation from there. This is kind of an interesting movie in a number of ways. The first one of which is the title character is very much a secondary role. And Donald Sutherland is very quiet and understated, and he doesn't have any of that goofy charm we know Donald Sutherland to have as one of his personas in movies. He kind of very much low-keys it as Klute and supports the star turn that is Jane Fonda's role as Bree the prostitute. I'm not sure if you can hear that, but outside the rain is pissing down at the moment. But then this is another reason why the movie is kind of interesting too. It takes a fairly non-judgmental approach to the fact that Bree's a call girl and shows her to be not just either a hard-hearted whore or the whore with a heart of gold. They were the two cliches of prostitution in Hollywood cinema. But she's a more complex person than that. She was working for a pimp who appears in the film, a very sleazy and unlovely character called Frank Ligurin, played by Roy Scheider. And Roy Scheider is very good in the role. He's very slick and smooth, and you can see why women trust him. And he's a totally disreputable character. He's an upper-class pimp. Now, previously, Bree was beaten up by one of the Johns and went to hospital for a little while. And when she came out, she ditched Frank as her pimp and kind of freelanced. She's trying to get out of the industry. We see her doing a couple of things, trying to be an actress, trying to be a model as well, being in a cattle call for each of those things and showing that maybe her skills and her look aren't perfect for that. But she's wants to leave the business in some way, but she needs the money, and so she does tricks. There's a guy from Chicago she sleeps with, and we kind of see Bree acting as a courtesan and doing what she needs to do in that. And there's a funny little business with a watch involved with that part of it. But as the script progresses, we inevitably, of course, Klute and Bree Daniels get closer together. He asks her questions. He's a very unreadable character. It's played so low-key by Donald Sutherland in this film that it's hard to read the emotions of Klute. We do inevitably have them sleep together and to form a tentative relationship. But all of the emotional heavy lifting in that stuff is done by Jane Fonda. And it's very much a star turn as well. She did spend time with pimps and prostitutes to learn the role. This comes after her scandalous at the time, visit to North Vietnam, where she was filmed on an anti-aircraft gun, and her protests against the Vietnam War, all that kind of thing. This is kind of, in some ways, a comeback role for her after that pissed off a lot of very powerful people in the US. But she is very good in it. I mean, it's a different role for her. The emotional complexity of the character does come across. There's a useful sounding board to help us understand Brie in the fact that she does have some improvised dialogue with her psychiatrist, played by a woman. They were going to get a man psychiatrist, but Jane Fonda insisted on a woman because she felt that a character like Brie wouldn't normally and naturally open up to a man. So they got a female actor to play the psychiatrist. And all of that was improvised at the end of shooting when Jane Fonda knew her character inside out. She'd done all the other filming for the script, and so she could improvise on the thought processes of the character of Brie and come across natural when she's talking to the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist acts as a sounding board and lets us as the audience understand that while she's attracted to Clute, she's also scared of losing her independence, and she doesn't want to go into a suburban domestic life, and she has ambitions, and she lived on Park Avenue when she was a high-priced call girl working for Frank, and there's a certain attraction to that lifestyle. But on the other hand, she knows she can't continue as a prostitute and keep her sense of self. So it's a very complex story. So you've got all of that going on. You've got the dynamic between Clute and Brie as he's investigating the disappearance of his boss, basically. And he's liaising with the one down boss, a guy called Peter Cable, played by Charles Joffe, who you might remember played Vincent Rossi, the policeman friend of John Shaft in the original Shaft movie with Richard Roundtree, around the same time as this film was made, maybe a little bit later. Now, Brie's ambiguity about her relationship with Clute plays out really interestingly in a disco scene. There's a discotheque, of course. There has to be. It's a 1971 movie set in New York City among people who aren't 100 years old, so there has to be a discotheque scene where Brie's talking to a bunch of people and flirting with guys, and Frank is there as well, her ex-pimp, and she does some very provocative things which are intended to piss off Clute. It's like she's testing him. She's with a conflicted character like this, where somebody is uncertain of their own feelings and things like that, they've got a tendency to test the other person and to do things that potentially will push them away. And Brie does this on a couple of occasions. Once after her and Clute first sleep together, and she seduces him in order to gain some control over him, or at least perceived control over him. And again, in the disco scene, she does provocative things to see how Clute will react, to test him and to test his attraction to her, I suppose. So there's a little bit of that. But then on the other hand, we've got the fact that the person who caused the disappearance of Tom Gruneman is slowly circling around Brie. He may be watching her. She feels that she's been watched for a while, and it's not just by Clute. And that character then kills a friend of hers, another prostitute, and so we get the more traditional narrative of the woman being stalked by basically a sexual psychopath, and that kind of dynamic there, which doesn't play out the way it would in a lot of other films. There are a lot of scream queen kind of roles based around that scenario, and that doesn't play like this. Brie is an intelligent and resourceful character. You can't really have been a prostitute in New York City without having some street smarts and some resourcefulness. So she doesn't in any way, when confronted ultimately by the character, and it's not too hard to figure out who it is in the narrative of the film, the character who killed Tom Gruneman and set her up as the person that ostensibly Tom Gruneman was sending the letters to, that dynamic doesn't play out anyway like a Scream Queen kind of thing. She's, at this stage, got enough trust in Clute to basically stall the guy as he confronts her in a clothing warehouse until, hopefully, Clute shows up. Now, the ending is very ambiguous. We don't really know for sure whether the villain is murdered or commits suicide by jumping out of a window. There's an ambiguity there, which I don't know whether it's bad cutting or maybe there's a bit that they didn't get any coverage on, or whether it's a deliberate ambiguity. But one way or the other, the villain, of course, dies at the end of the film. It's no surprise for this kind of film to have that as a part of it. And this has also got a bit of that interesting thing of insider knowledge, knowing how prostitution worked in New York City at the time. How does a freelance call girl get dates? How does it work? How does she approach it as a person? How does she deal with the aftermath of it? And we're getting a very interesting insight into Brie as a character after she sleeps with the guy from Chicago and how she winds down from pulling a trick. And you know, how does she kind of center herself after such an intense and personally intrusive acting role, which she sees it as an acting role, how she winds down from that. And then, of course, we get a sense of her loneliness and her isolation and how she wants to get out of the life. Now, from my cultural viewpoint, which is slightly different than an American cultural viewpoint, well, significantly in some ways, the criminalization of prostitution just seems stupid to me. Yes, it's not an easy job, and yes, it's a job that's not without its hazards, and it's a job that's not looked at kindly by society. But where I live, and in my culture, it is a legal job, and sex work can... there are various different groups, some against, some for, and some for kind of destigmatizing that kind of work. And I can understand where they're coming from. They know a lot more about it than me. And if a group of sex worker collective or sex worker advocates say that the job doesn't demean them by their own lights, and that they're at least a certain percentage of their people perceive it as an empowering thing and not a degrading thing, then I'm willing to believe them on that, that that's how they see things. I'm not making any judgments about prostitution. I haven't used a prostitute myself, but I do know people that have, and I have socially met several people who have worked as sex workers. And I'm never going to judge them about that. I just think people need to do what they need to do to survive. Some make good judgment calls about that. Some make bad judgment calls. Some make judgment calls that arrive at them at a certain time, and then that changes. Life changes, and I'm not going to judge people about the choice of work that they choose to do. I've got another thought about people who try to coerce other people into sex work. That's a totally different thing, but I'm talking about voluntary sex work. I don't think it should be a crime. I don't think that people should be part of the underworld for doing it. I just think that we really need to have a more mature and a more adult attitude to those kind of transactions / relationships. And one of the problems that, of course, Brie has is she can't necessarily go to the police about this stalker because that brings her to their attention. And so having Clute as a private investigator come along does, in a weird sense, help her with this man who's obviously stalking her and who has killed several other people before her. And so Clute, in a sense, can be seen as rescuing her, even though she doesn't necessarily come across as a character that needs rescuing. Though ultimately, Clute breaking in does precipitate whatever that ambiguous ending of the stalker's life is about, whether he pushed her, whether she pushed him, whether he pushed him, whether she pushed him, whether the guy got startled and fell out of the window. We don't know. All we know is that something about Clute arriving on the scene precipitated the death of the psychopath. Now, Donald Sutherland, even though it is a low-key role for him, is very good in it. If you see him in his more gonzo roles of the times in movies like Kelly's Heroes and other things like that, Alice in Wonderland, all those kind of stuff, and his little turn in Little Murders. Having this kind of low-key, very straight-laced role was a departure for him at the time. And he is very good if low-key. Just, if you see the film, just watch the acting by Donald Sutherland. It is there, and it is, he's a generous enough actor to play that supportive role for the star turn that is Jane Fonda's Bree. And she's very good in it as well. It's a bit of a change for her as a character actor. She'd done a lot of lighter stuff. Of course, she'd done Barbarella. She did sex comedies like Sunday in New York in the early 60s. She did stuff with Roger Vadim, including Barbarella and other things as well. And really atrocious bits of rubbish like Otto Preminger's Hurry Sundown, when Michael Caine plays a southerner. And yeah, this one does show her intelligence and bravery as an actor, which I really like as well. She's got that kind of shag haircut at the time. She doesn't wear a bra throughout the movie, which I found at the time I first saw this very, very alluring. And to be honest with you, she is still very attractive in this film. And, of course, she is today too. I mean, what is she? She's in her 70s. And Jane Fonda is still a very striking woman to this day, and all strength to her for that, though I'm sure that there are a number of medical procedures that aided her in that. But yeah, I do like this movie. I think it's got that 70s look about it. It's just on the fringe of disco, so it's got that little kind of disco thing with a nightclub scene. It's got a touch of voyeurism. There's a bit where the psychopath plays a recording, an audio recording he made of him killing the other girl. And there's a deep sense of violation and voyeurism about that particular part when I rewatched it this time. And I wasn't as comfortable with it as I was the first time. But there is very good voice acting by the actor in question. And I'm not doing the spoiler. You can watch the movie yourself. In that part, which kind of does portray things and also lets the imagination of the audience think what he's actually doing to the woman at the time. And our imagination's always going to be a lot worse than had they shown it. So there's the kind of theatre of the mind thing working in that scene where he plays that audio recording for Brie to kind of foreshadow what he has planned for her. But just to wind it up with Clute, it's a nice little thriller of the time. It's a very good acting role by Jane Fonda. Scheider's really good playing the pimp, and it's a totally different role for Roy Scheider from the ones we're familiar with in Jaws and all that jazz and the French Connection and all that kind of thing. He is very accomplished and very smooth and very perfect as Frank the pimp. There are a number of other smaller acting roles in there. Gene Stapleton turns up as a receptionist at one point. But, yeah, the movie does work, and it shows a more enlightened attitude to sex workers than a lot of movies of the time, for instance. But anyway, that's about it for Clute. I really am glad that I watched it, and I'm going to have to watch all The President's Men now and throw that into the podcast at some stage. So I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, there's some feedback as well.
Brazil, where hearts were entertaining June, we stood beneath an ember moon and softly murmured someday soon we kissed and clung together. Then tomorrow was another day. The morning found me miles away, with still a million things to say. Now, when twilight dims the sky above, recalling thrills of our love, there's one thing I'm certain of: return I will to old Brazil. to say. Oh, now, when twilight dims the sky above, recalling thrills of our love, there's one thing I'm certain of, return.
That was German lounge singer Tom Gabel's version of Ari Barroso's Brazil. I think we've got about 20 different versions of Brazil, but that one at the moment's my favourite. I like the one that Rosemary Clooney did with Bing Crosby and the one they did for the Eddie Duchin story movie. There are tons of versions of Brazil out there. Anyway, so it's on to the feedback, and I've got two pieces of feedback, which is a rare and wonderful thing. Keith Shockley sent me a really nice little email saying, "Greetings, Terry. Just recently discovered the podcast and have been enjoying your take on all things cinema. Especially enjoyed your recent musings on Easy Rider with Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda. And that got me wondering if you'd ever seen 1971's The Hired Hand, directed by and starring Fonda, along with Warren Oates and Werner Blum. It's been often referred to as a psychedelic western or an easy rider with horses, but those descriptions do not do the film justice. It's one of my favourite movies of any genre, and although it received mixed reviews at the time of its release, it has developed a huge cult following over the years. The film features absolutely stunning cinematography by Wilma Sigmund and a beautiful haunting score by Bruce Langhorne. It's a simple film about complex characters, and the performances by the three leads are pitch perfect. It contains one of my all-time favourite performances by my all-time favourite actor, Warren Oates. By the way, if you're a fan of Oates, I highly recommend the Susan Compo biography, Warren Oates, A Wild Life. Regardless, hope you can check it out if you haven't seen it. Keep up the great work and take care, mate." Thanks, Keith. Yes, I have seen it a long time ago. In fact, I met Peter Fonda once when he was out here promoting Yuli's Gold. Very nice guy, very tall, but he's got that kind of cool old hippie serenity about him, which was really nice. And I do have a copy, I've got an ebook copy of Warren Oates' Wildlife, and I've started to read it, but then I got sucked into James Ellroy's novels, and I've been reading LA Confidential, having read The Big Nowhere, and got sucked into that. But I did do a Paleo Cinema episode all about Warren Oates way back in the day. I'm going to find out which episode it was so you can listen to it. Give me a sec. Thank you, Uncle Google. It was Paleo Cinema Podcast number 41 from around 2010, and it was called The United States of Warren Oates, and it got quite a good little review. In fact, The Onion AV Club, it's one of the episodes name-checked in the review I got on The Onion AV Club about Paleo Cinema in about 2012. So it's a highly regarded episode. So if you want to listen to that one, Keith, please feel free to do so. So I got that particular email, which is kind of nice, and I do have another one, but my computer's just gone a tad slow on me. So I'm just going to take a moment to waffle here while it thinks about letting me into it. And it's from our old mate Morris, who I had a coffee with at lunchtime today. "Hey, Terry, I enjoyed your flight disaster episode from the safety of my backyard, not 10,000 feet in the air, I'm pleased to say. A very recent anthology film I watched had a segment that would contribute very well to a short feature for your double. There's a new Argentinian film called Wild Tales by a director called Damien Zifron. Every short story in the film has a tale of revenge, both serious and blackly comic. It's one of the rare anthology films where every tale has something to recommend it, without giving too much away, and please don't watch the spoiler-filled trailer. The opening segment set on an aeroplane is something that would be a nice accompaniment to any cinema showing of Airport or any other aero disaster films. I urge you to see Wild Tales. There's also a segment in there that I'm sure is paying some homage to Duel. Speak soon. Cheers, Morris." Yeah, thanks, Morris. I have added that to the list of films to watch, which is a very large and increasing list of films to watch. But yeah, we had a nice chat today at lunchtime, sitting outside a cafe, watching the rain, and caught up a little bit and talked movies and stuff like that, and achieved things and congratulate ourselves on our achievements, and had just a nice little confab, which we do about once or twice a month, depending on when either of us can get free at lunchtime. But yeah, thanks for that, Morris. I'm going to have to do some more themed episodes, I think, because they do seem to flow a little bit easier for me. And this being a one-man band kind of effort, I really do need to kind of do that. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. Thank you for your attention. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of the Patreon subscribers who are going to get mentioned in the credits in just a minute when I re-record them, because I did promise I would re-record the credits to include all of the supporters on them. In the meantime, look after yourselves. Watch good movies. Take care. Don't let the bastards grind you down. Stay warm, stay cool, depending on which hemisphere you're in. And keep watching really good films. I'll catch you soon. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, the New York unit director, and Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.